as Dottie said, simulating the universes. And I'll just call attention to my collaborators, including Luis, and this postdoc that is working for us in Santa Cruz at UC Santa Cruz, Max Wainwright, who I cannot tell you enough about how awesome he is and how much great work he did on this project. So what are we going to talk about? So there's this idea of eternal inflation, which postulates that there is some inflating metastable phase that is constantly spawning off these bubbles here. And maybe there's many different kinds of bubbles. Because the rate of expansion in general, generically, is faster than the rate at which you make these bubbles and stop the expansion inside of them, this phase transition that you see here just never percolates. It just constantly makes all of these bubbles. And then, of course, the story is that if you look hard enough inside one of these bubbles, you'll find our observable universe. And there's all sorts of horrid complications with this idea, and who knows if it even really makes sense. But of course, one should possibly take it seriously because it's a fairly generic consequence of quantum field theory, spontaneous symmetry breaking, and accelerated expansion. Okay, but who cares about the justifications unless you can actually see something? So as many of you know, of course, I've been interested in this question for quite a while of whether or not you can experimentally verify this idea of eternal inflation. And one route to experimental verification is to note that in that soup of bubbles, our bubble does not necessarily evolve in isolation. Perhaps there can be overlaps and collisions between different bubbles. And of course, this could possibly give us some handle on this as a signature.
So I've always been very puzzled by this because this implies that the bubbles are expanding in some other space that's perhaps a four-dimensional space or a higher dimensional space
So it could just be our universe. For example, if it's just the standard model in a desert up to the Planck scale, we live in that universe because the Higgs is, we're in a metastable phase of the Higgs, and there's accelerated expansion. So every once in a while, there will be this pocket that forms somewhere. If we're unlucky enough to be there, then we get eaten up and we're dead.
But it's not the expansion and the formation of bubbles that disturbs me, but it's the fact that you can say bubbles collide because... Mm-hmm. When they're expanding, they're presumably just generating their own space. They're
so this is
some other space.
Sure, absolutely. So you need to solve the relativistic equations with this matter content that I'll assume, and I'll show you precisely how to do that. Yeah. So there's this idea, this possibly crazy idea. We want to know if you can find any possible tests of this crazy idea that we could verify. So I'll just review a little bit how our universe might fit into this picture. So our matter content is going to be some scalar field, and that scalar field will have a potential that looks maybe something like this, where there's a metastable false vacuum and possibly a stable true vacuum. And within this potential, if I start myself up in this metastable false vacuum, then every once in a while, there's some probability I'll form a bubble in real space inside of which I make that true vacuum phase. Okay, and inside this bubble, from the symmetries of the Euclidean instanton that mediates this transition, there is an empty, open Robertson-Walker universe where the Big Bang of this Robertson-Walker universe is just this light cone emanating from the center of the bubble. Okay, and it's empty because, well, there's no energy left here. I can't liberate any energy from this false vacuum to go into making stuff inside my bubble. It just all goes into accelerating the wall, and nothing interesting happens. And this is why the original idea of inflation introduced by Alan Guth failed, because he had some inflating phase and some non-inflating phase, and generically you do this slow, so you just make one big empty bubble, and nothing interesting happens. So one way to save this is to modify the potential a little bit over here so that now after tunneling you have this slow roll phase and then reheating and everything else follows. So now I have my bubble, and inside of this light cone, instead of having nothing, I now have slow roll inflation, reheating, and then eventually all of the cosmology that we observe today. And these are known as models of open inflation because we used to think the universe was open. So people wanted to come up with a good way to set that up, set the initial conditions for that up, and this was a good way to do that. Okay, it's recently come back with a vengeance because people believe, some of them, in this idea that the string theory landscape might give us a picture that looks something like this, or more generically, this just arises in theories that have spontaneous symmetry breaking and accelerated expansion. So however you want to motivate it, that's the model. Now, every model that I will write down today is terribly ugly, so I'll just come out and say that and tell you why. So if I look at these potentials that drive both eternal inflation and slow roll inflation, there is a sort of contradictory condition that needs to be met. So to make the bubbles, I need to have this Coleman-DeLucia instanton. And that only exists when the curvature of this barrier is really large. So when V double prime over V normalized to M Planck squared is big. However, that, you'll recognize, is just the second slow roll condition. So if I want to have slow roll, I have to have part of this potential where I have exactly the opposite limit. Okay. So somehow, the price of entry here, if I just want to have a single field model, the price of entry is this terrible hierarchy in scales.
What is the problem with doing the other thing where V double prime is small and you can also
top? So you could have Hawking-Moss. Then I don't know what I'm talking about because I don't have a confident picture of what the sort of large scale structure would look like. So. Okay, so here is again a picture of this potential, and there were colors on my laptop, but they don't show up here for some reason. But you can think about sort of three regions on this potential. And those map in space-time into regions of this single bubble. Region one tells us about the outside of the bubble wall, and how it evolves. And that just involves the parts of the potential effectively under this barrier. There's region two, which allows me to paste together these two regions which have this very large hierarchy and scales. So that's just some interpolating region. And then there's region three, which is where a slow roll is supposed to happen. Okay, so these are the three sort of qualitatively different features here that map onto these three regions. And you can think of bubble phenomenology basically as embedding different models of inflation inside different bubbles. Okay. So I could take my favorite bubble, which is determined by this barrier, and then I could define whatever interpolating region is necessary to sort of slop on my favorite model of slow roll inflation. And this is always going to work, you know, with arbitrary tuning. Okay, and so this model here, you can think of basically as a calculable theory of statistically isotropic initial conditions for your favorite model of inflation. Okay. So the bubble is really just there to act as an initial conditions generator for your favorite model of inflation. And you can think of that effectively as bubble phenomenology, if you like.
So under the conditions, is there no like thing where you can say this model of inflation cannot be fit inside the bubble, isn't it?
No. I mean, with arbitrary tuning. So you have to, you know, define this terrible interpolating region two that connects on your favorite bubble to your favorite model of inflation. But given an arbitrary amount of tuning, that will always be possible. So that's all set up by the instanton, but the instanton doesn't care about anything except for the part of the potential in region one. So by model of inflation, I mean potential. So this is setting the initial conditions, including the curvature. No, I don't think that's true. If this is just one construction. I mean, you can imagine a different set of initial conditions, a different history of the universe where it was spatially closed or flat or whatever you like. But the thing is that here, if I give you this potential, all of those initial conditions are basically set automatically. Okay. So the fact that I have this instanton, the fact that I can set up this bubble with negative curvature is setting up the initial conditions for my model of inflation. But you could imagine something else. This isn't the only game in town. I don't know. That's a great question. You know, debated question. What, you know, if you have that context, what is the preferred cosmological history? And I don't think anyone knows. This is just one game.
But you're going to contradict yourself later on that to say that this doesn't set the initial conditions and there might be other bubbles, right?
I'll get there in two slides. Okay. But I won't contradict myself. Yeah.
Just to clarify. So sure.
That's exactly right. That's right. Yeah. So the when I say model of inflation, really I mean this region 3. Okay. So whatever comes before is basically a machine to make this homogeneous initial condition for my model of inflation.
One quick question actually about what this all said. Uh-huh. Is that why it's not easy to explain than just go on, but this business about how you said you didn't
I don't think it's really a bubble. There's the sort of semi-classical picture of what that looks like is just far less clear than it is in this case. I don't think it's undefinable, but it's just a lot less clear. Okay, so this is just a machine to make initial conditions for your favorite model of inflation, or that's one way you can think about it. Okay, so what about observable effects before we talk about collisions? There's other observable effects. So one of them is the fact that we predict that we live in an open universe. Okay, that's a generic prediction of this model. We know that we can't live in a too open universe from Planck. That says that omega curvature is less than about 10 to the minus 2. That's the current best constraint. And you can think of that as mapping onto something like the number of e-folds driven by your favorite model of inflation, plus whatever details of reheating happen down here. So the observed curvature is some combination of the number of e-folds and the reheat temperature, et cetera. So that's one thing one could possibly see. Another thing is that there is a theory of initial conditions. So we can set the vacuum state, and the vacuum state is set outside the bubble in this false vacuum. And so that's a modified vacuum from the standard Bunch-Davies in your favorite model of inflation, so there's some small effects due to that. The fact that you're starting from this high-energy De Sitter space means that there will be quantum mechanical fluctuation of tensor modes, and those tensor modes are on top of the ones you get from the standard slow roll inside your bubble, so there's extra tensors. And then also, because you live in an open universe, there is this set of so-called supercurvature modes that are discrete modes that exist in addition to the continuum of K modes inside of a slow roll model of inflation. So you have these. All of these modify the power spectrum of inflation on very large angular scales. That's difficult to observe, but possible. And then finally, you've got this region 2 that you slopped on in order to fix this problem of the hierarchy between the wall region and the slow roll region. And that feature in the potential might lead to effects in the power spectrum. For example, there's this recent paper by Busseau, Harlow, and Senatore that discussed this possibility. So there are these observational effects that come just from modifications of the power spectrum. And again, this is sort of setting up homogeneous, or at least statistically homogeneous, initial conditions for your favorite model of inflation. Okay, so now is where I contradict myself, as Niyash said. So the other observational effect is going to be the collision between bubbles, right? So we don't just have one. In that picture I showed you in the beginning of the movie, there were many, and then there's some probability that these bubbles hit each other. So here is a cartoon picture of what happens when these two bubbles collide. Okay, so just a few quick reminders of some of the important aspects. So remember, this was the Big Bang of this bubble. So any collision is always going to be in our past. It has to come through this Big Bang surface in order to get to us. So collisions are always in our past. That's the buzz line. The outcome is fixed basically just by the theory, the potential. So the potential sets up the space-time and the kinematics. So how far apart were these bubbles in some center of mass frame? And then finally, so these bubble nucleation events are basically some random stochastic process. I think there are a lot of interesting open questions trying to understand that random stochastic process. But at this point, basically, you just say there's some probability per unit time, per unit volume, that you make bubbles from this false vacuum. So one way to think about collisions, then, would be a calculable theory of inhomogeneous initial conditions for your favorite model of inflation. So this process of colliding bubbles, you can think of as effectively just setting up different initial conditions for inflation, whatever your favorite model is. And it's calculable, as I'll show throughout the rest of the talk. Okay, so what do I mean by predictions and just cartoon pictures? How would I go about making a prediction? So we start with a model, and that model gives rise to eternal inflation, and it gives rise to bubbles. So let's pick a really simple model that just has one kind of bubble to make our lives easy. We go from that model to this space-time picture of a single bubble. And there's not just one, there's many. So in order to make a prediction, I do have to understand some of the properties of this eternally inflating space-time. And maybe a really simplistic property that is useful is, say, the probability per unit time, per unit volume that I make bubbles. So that tells me roughly what the structure of this space is on the largest scales. So then I zoom in on this picture and I look at individual bubbles and I see that they undergo collisions. So in order to make a prediction, I need to understand the properties of these inhomogeneous cosmologies produced by collisions. And then, once I'm done with that, I need to identify some stuff that I want to observe. So one observable, say, would be fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation, as we'll discuss. And so I have this ensemble of observational signatures. And since I have an ensemble, I need a probability distribution over all of these possibilities. So why do I get an ensemble? First of all, this process of bubble nucleation is some stochastic process. So this is not going to be the only realization of some set of collisions. There's going to be many realizations of different kinds of collisions. And then there's the fact that I have an inhomogeneous cosmology, so it matters where the observer is, even if I fix the realization. So someone here would see something different than someone here, who would see something different than someone there. Okay, so there's this intrinsic variability, and hence any prediction that I make is intrinsically going to be a probabilistic prediction. And then the shorthand is, fix the model and just go to this ensemble of predictions. Okay, so to summarize then, one possible set of objects that would constitute a prediction would be something like, okay, how many of these events do I expect to see? What is a set of observables characterizing each of these events? And then how many of each type do I expect to find? Some probability distribution. Okay. So that's the ambition. We really want to calculate from first principles, given this model, this set of objects. And then that's something that one could do, one could use to go and constrain data with this theory, right? If I have this set of objects, I can make a likelihood because this is what I need to generate fake data. Think about it that way. Okay, so let's do it. Actually, before let's do it, I want to make one quick argument, which is that this is really basically what we do in slow roll inflation. Okay. So in slow roll inflation, I have some model, and that model gives rise to some homogeneous evolution, and it gives rise to an ensemble of possible inhomogeneous universes that come from the quantum mechanics of the inflaton field. And then I map on to a probability distribution over the CLs in the CMB. Okay, and so this involves all of the four elements that I discussed. It involves a theory of initial conditions. Why did I start here on the hill in the Bunch-Davies vacuum? It involves dynamics. How are these quantum mechanical fluctuations produced? How do they evolve? It involves a map to observables. And the thing that I get in the end is intrinsically probabilistic. Okay, so that's that. Now let's go through these steps. So first of all, we have to pick a model. So here's my horribly ugly model with this incredible fine-tuning. So if you zoom in on that piece of the potential here, you will see that in fact there is a false vacuum and some potential barrier is just really smushed on this scale. So there, the second derivative is huge. And then here is my model of inflation where the slow roll condition is satisfied. And let's just pick something simple like m squared phi squared. Okay. And then there's some region in between the barrier and this m squared phi squared potential that just acts to match it smoothly. Okay, so I have this horrible model, which is, you know, just match a barrier suitable for some Kolmogorov-Dilutsch instanton onto chaotic inflation. And maybe we could vary that model a little bit. So since this is horribly fine-tuned, why not? We could vary the matching point to vary the duration of inflation. We could rescale the potential to vary the nucleation rate. That depends on things like the barrier height. But no matter how much of this screwing around we do, let's just make sure that we make a phenomenologically viable model of single bubble open inflation. And all of the models that we'll consider will be such. Okay, so that's our model. You can object to it. It's terribly fine-tuned, but it's just a straw man. So this is just something to play with. Yeah?
Could it be that the model taken by itself with collisions isn't viable, but the model with collisions is? So you could, you know, x squared, phi squared is, you know, on the outside of two sigma without collisions, but you have some collisions, then it's okay.
Great question. I have no idea. Yeah. Probably be a miracle if that happened, but possibly. Okay, so that's the model. Now we're going to condense the properties of this eternally inflating spacetime into one number that we care about, which is this prediction for how many of these collisions are causally accessible. So just how many of these would I expect to see? And that depends on two parts. So it depends on this region one. So that's the nucleation rate per unit four volume normalized to the false vacuum Hubble constant squared. And it also depends on these two parts here. So there's the present day observed curvature and then whatever scale inflation happens at. And before discussing what natural values this might take, we can just bifurcate models into two classes, ones that are testable and ones that are not. So unless this predicted causally accessible number is significantly greater than one, then forget about it. This is not going to be a useful way to try and test these models.
Well, I mean, if you predict to be minus than one and you see one, then that rules out the one.
True. Okay, so that's the first two parts of that story. And then the third part is going to take a little bit more time. So now I zoom in on this eternally inflating universe, and I ask about the properties of these collisions between bubbles. So the fundamental postulate is that collisions are rare, and so we can consider them individually. That's a lot easier than trying to simulate this whole mess. So first, we discuss the symmetries of this collision space-time. So here I show you a space-space picture of two individual bubbles that nucleate a distance 2b away from each other with an initial radius r naught. And their trajectory in time is just, for each of these individual bubbles, this hyperbolic trajectory, if we're talking about flat space. So after this initial time, these bubbles expand, and then they collide. And because the intersection of two hyperbolae is a hyperboloid of one lower dimension, we retain this symmetry for the collision between any two individual bubbles. So the collision spacetime has this SO21 hyperbolic symmetry, which was first discovered by Hawking, Moss, and Stewart a long time ago. And that's nice because that means there's enough symmetries to reduce this problem to one space and one time dimension.
Matt,
yep.
If I were to argue to you that that's actually, for reasons I won't go into now, secretly too much symmetry and you actually have to think plus symmetry, and I might expect more significant observations, do you have anything to say about this?
I think that's an idealization. I totally agree that there would be departures from that. I don't know. My suspicion is that they're at least in the initial time when the bubbles collide, fairly small departures, but I could be wrong. Without this simplification, it's much more difficult technically, but it's not impossible to carry out the procedure that I'll describe. But that's an operating assumption, if you like. Could be wrong, but I think it's right. Okay. So we have these two bubbles. That's the symmetry. We have this problem in one space and one time dimension. And I would argue that to definitively study what happens, you really need full GR and numerics. Why? Well, we want to find the post-collision cosmology. So this distribution of matter gets screwed up by the collision, and I want to turn that into a real cosmology. So I need to know the metric. So I should be able to, I should need to study how the distribution of this matter back reacts on the geometry, hence I need GR. Typically, there's going to be a huge center of mass energy in the collision. You might worry about things like black holes. Actually, that's forbidden. But anyways, the energy densities get very large, so you might worry about relativistic effects. And the potential that we're considering is nonlinear, the field equations are nonlinear, and so in the absence of any small perturbations, which don't exist in this problem, you should really solve the full problem. So you should do this in GR. Okay, so this postdoc, Max Wainwright, that I mentioned, wrote this fantastic evolution code in Python and C, which exhibits fourth order convergence. It's got this creative way of implementing adaptive mesh refinement and cutting out the regions of the simulation that you sort of care most about and discarding the rest. And I can't emphasize, you know, how great of a job he did. This is awesome. So here's how it goes. We first have to pick a gauge. So let's pick a coordinate system to work in. This is a metric which exhibits the hyperbolic symmetry that I discussed earlier manifestly in this part. And it's got two free metric functions, which are going to be a function of these two variables that we can that we have. So there's n and x. And one way to understand this coordinate system is to go to pure de Sitter space, in which case a and alpha are equal to 1. N, you can see, then basically measures the number of e folds of inflation in this de Sitter phase, and x is effectively a comoving distance. So that's the coordinate system. Here's the evolution equations, which are complicated, but nevertheless can be solved. And then there's a constraint equation coming from Einstein's equation that should be satisfied. So that's our system of equations that we want to put into a computer and solve.
So where are the spatial gradients, the primes?
Yeah, so the primes are the spatial gradients there. Phi is the field. Pi is some analog of the time derivative of the field, so we can get a first order formulation. And then we've got these factors A and B, which are some complicated function of these metric functions and spatial derivatives and whatnot. Okay, so that's our set of evolution equations. We need to stick in some initial conditions to that. And a rather nice property of this gauge is that as n goes to zero, if we look at the evolution equations, the only way that they're not singular in the limit that n goes to zero is if we get the following Taylor expansion about n equals zero for all of these quantities that appeared in that equation of motion. Okay, so basically everything has to go to one up to a factor of n squared as n goes to zero. And we can stick these into the equation of motion and solve them for the initial values of the metric functions and this piece of the field that goes like n squared in terms of some an arbitrary initial field configuration. Okay, so phi naught is just some arbitrary initial field profile, and that uniquely determines all of these quantities that we need to start the evolution at a finite n. So this initial field profile is determined basically by just taking two individual bubble configurations that are solved fully for these Coleman-Deluge instantons and putting them far apart enough that they don't overlap. And that's going to be our set of initial conditions. Okay? So these instantons are constructed using this publicly available code that Max authored, which can be found here, called Cosmo Transitions, which is also very nice. It's written in Python. It's very user-friendly. And it will find any Coleman-Deluge instanton you want for single or multiple fields. Yeah?
So that limit as n goes to zero is just the empty ambient attending place in Coleman vacuum. So they all go to one.
It's not quite. So so if we look at this metric, I'll try and draw a picture. So it's this weird anisotropic slicing. So if we generalize that to flat space, what we'd get is if I embed this in Minkowski space, we'd have the x-axis. And emanating from the x-axis would be a light cone. So I'd get this trough, this sort of triangular trough. Okay, and inside that trough, these hypersurfaces here would be constant n. And moving along these hypersurfaces would be moving in rho. Okay? So as I go to n equals 0, you can think about this almost like a Bianchi universe or some like weird Bianchi slicing of flat space. And so if I looked at the effective Friedmann equation, you see that anisotropy always dominates as I go to n equals 0. So any non-singular configuration as n goes to 0 is an anisotropy-dominated universe. And so that's why these metric functions are forced to go to 1 up to n squared. Okay. So any field configuration that I draw along the bottom of this trough basically just doesn't back-react on the geometry at all in the limit that n goes to 0. So I can paint any field configuration I want at n equals 0. And then this gives me a prescription for how to look at it at finite n when I include the back reaction. Yes. Okay, so here is the result. So here's an example of a collision between two bubbles in this horribly complicated model that I talked about earlier. So the magenta lines are the approximate location of the bubble walls. So here is where my two bubbles collide. You can see the effect of this. If we look at this contour plot, here is the value of phi. In the future of this collision, the inflaton is basically advanced a little bit down its potential. Okay? And everything is going vertical because, remember, this distance x is kind of like a co-moving position. Okay. So here are the metric functions, alpha and a. I guess I don't have much intuition for what these tell me off the bat, but anyway, there they are for completeness.
So what is the distance of the bubbles compared to the size of each bubble?
Yeah, so on this, it's kind of hard to see here, but you know, x is measured in units of the false vacuum Hubble scale. So these are about a tenth the size of the false vacuum Hubble scale, and they're separated by a distance of order the false vacuum Hubble scale. So the initial separation is roughly 10 times bigger than the initial size. Yeah, so here we're colliding identical bubbles in this simple model that only allows for one kind of bubble. But of course, one would want to look at more complicated potentials where you're colliding bubbles that have different interior values of the field. And I could discuss that afterwards or in the questions if you like. Okay, so we run this simulation all the way from the beginning of these bubbles forming through approximately 60 E-folds of inflation inside each of the bubbles. So we really simulate the entire cosmology. And this takes about 7 minutes on a laptop, so it's actually quite fast. And you can see the upshot from this picture is that the red region is where inflation has ended, and the effect of this collision is basically to end inflation prematurely in some region of space. So there's some nice story about the dynamics. It took me a second to digest this plot that Max made, but here are the two initial field configurations, and the different colors show you these bubbles as they expand for different values of n. Okay, so the bubbles come together and collide, and at the moment of collision, basically what happens is these field profiles just superpose linearly. And that leads to an advance of this inflaton field down the slope by a distance of order the barrier width. So here's the barrier width. In the future of the collision, I basically get shot down of order the barrier width. And in the ultra-relativistic limit, when these bubbles get further and further apart, I just continuously approach this superposition principle. And this was something discovered by Richard Easter, Eugene Lim, and Yisheng Yang. And I think they called it the free passage approximation. So this is just some ultra-relativistic phenomenon where the dynamics become very simple. Okay, so we figured out what the space-time looks like inside of these colliding bubbles. And we have this more or less global metric. So we know the metric everywhere in this collision space-time. However, what we want is to find the metric or some quantity that tells us about perturbations inside one of these individual bubbles. Okay, so we have this coordinate system that covers everything and tells me about everything, but really I want to specialize to what's going on inside of one of these perturbed bubbles. So that's not straightforward. I can't just invent a coordinate transformation that takes me from this global metric to the thing inside. That's black magic. But we'll see that there is a black magic way of doing it. And there's different possible approaches I might take. So one approach would be to try and identify covariant, coordinate independent quantities that tell me what I'm interested in. And there is such a way to do it. In fact, there's a nice paper by Xu et al. Who look at perturbations in a bouncing cosmology, and they take this co-moving approach. So they actually extract numerically what the co-moving curvature perturbation is in a covariant manner, which is kind of nice. Another thing we could do is pick a region of space inside this bubble and try and do some local expansion of the metric about that point. So this is something analogous to Fermi coordinates, where then possibly I could map out a region that looks approximately like an open Robertson-Walker universe. We won't do that either. Instead, what we'll do is to note a nice geometrical property about these spacetimes, which is that there's a direct map between labeled geodesics and the perturbed metric that we care about. So if I just look at a single bubble, and I go to time equals zero, so I go really near this light cone, then all non-singular metrics necessarily approach the Milne slicing of Minkowski space. So the position is labeled by x, y, z, but there's another way of understanding this position label. It's basically a geodesic which is shot out from the origin with rapidity given by 2 times the arctan of the radial distance over 2. And co-moving geodesics don't evolve, so these geodesic labels are also good coordinate labels, and they just are the coordinate labels for all time. Okay? So this congruence of geodesics really just defines what I mean by spatial distance along one of these constant time hypersurfaces. So let's try and adapt that now to the problem where I have two bubbles. Is there a similar geometric way of understanding some appropriate coordinate system? So here, again, we look at this limit where n goes to 0 in that global metric we had before. And all non-singular metrics always approach this form here, which is this sort of anisotropy-dominated universe. It's some anisotropic slicing of Minkowski space. And we can choose a slicing of Milne, because we know that this has to look like Milne, which preserves this hyperbolic symmetry. Okay? And here is a simple anisotropic slicing of Milne that manifests this hyperbolic symmetry, where we just have this simple relation between the global metric in that limit as n goes to 0 and this new coordinate system involving the variables tau and xi. So our geodesic labels are now going to be some position xi, which is related to the rapidity again, and then these angular positions rho, which tell me how far along I am along one of these constant time hypersurfaces, and some azimuthal angle I can't draw because I can't draw four dimensions on the board. So this set of coordinates that manifest the hyperbolic symmetry, I apologize, you can't really see anything in this figure. If we were to look at Minkowski space, the Poincaré disk of Minkowski space, which is just Minkowski space plotted on a constant time hypersurface with this metric here, okay? So that's x, x and y. And then I were to look at what these anisotropic coordinates look like on here. You can't see them, but this would be a constant xi surface on this plot, okay? So the collision has this hyperbolic symmetry, and that manifests itself if I were to paint the collision onto one of these constant time hypersurfaces. This would be a line of symmetry. So that is just to give you some intuition for these coordinates. Okay, so I have all of these geodesic labels. I know how to set up their initial condition because I know how the labels xi are related to the global simulation coordinates n at this early time. So I have this set of initial conditions, and then I have a set of geodesic equations which tell me how all of these geodesics with different initial conditions evolve through my simulation for which I know the metric. And so I can just solve these geodesic equations to get a coordinate mapping between n and x, my simulation coordinates, and xi and tau, these coordinates that I care about which foliate the inside of the bubble. Okay? So just by brute force, we simulate thousands and thousands of geodesics passing through the simulation, and then we build up some table of this map and then form an interpolating function, and then that gives us this map. Yeah, so whenever they intersect, of course, you have a caustic and the coordinate system breaks. Generically, we never find that to be true. So it's never true for this example. It's never true for many of the examples we've studied. Where you might get into trouble is when these geodesics start penetrating into some domain wall. Let me be more clear. So we pick a bubble, and then around that point, we send out this set of geodesics. Okay, so our coordinate system is only going to foliate the inside of one of these bubbles. Okay, so here's a better picture of that map, actually. So what we're doing is we're performing this simulation in a frame. Okay, it's a frame where these two bubbles that are colliding nucleate at more or less the same time. It's sort of the analog of a center of mass frame. Let's give it a name. We'll call it the collision frame. Okay, so if I just pick two points here, these are just reference points. If I'm looking at this at some later time, I'm at some position. Okay, so let's say I'm at the position of this red dot. And I'm definitely not going to be at the origin of coordinates. Okay, that's inconvenient because if I look at null rays in this weird coordinate system, they act in a complicated manner. So we can simplify our life by performing a translation in this coordinate system so that any observer I care about is located at the origin of coordinates. And the main convenience that comes from that is that his past light cone or his null rays will always travel radially outwards. So his past light cone projected onto some constant time hypersurface will always be a circle. And that's just convenient. So what happens is, well, these reference points obviously just get shifted over in some way. And then if these lines of symmetry in this original frame, which are what the collision products would lie on or whatever perturbation would lie on, they basically get mapped into these curved hypersurfaces. And there's some complicated map that you can derive which tells you how to do this. Basically, you're just relabeling your geodesics in an appropriate way. Okay, so we have this set of coordinate transformations. We just stick them all into here, and we use the standard tensor transformation law to get a metric in a perturbed open Robertson-Walker universe where your observer is located at the origin from this simulation metric. Okay, and that's just some chain of coordinate transformations that you can define and carry out this operation. And now we want to map onto quantities that I care about for observation. So I want to map onto the scalar parts of a perturbed Robertson-Walker metric. And implicitly, we're working in the synchronous gauge because our set of geodesics are giving us a metric, which is negative d tau squared plus a bunch of stuff. So the scalar component, of course, can be decomposed into a trace and then this trace-free symmetric part. And empirically, we find that the vector components are small, as they should be. So those decay away during an inflationary phase, and they do. And the tensors are zero by symmetry. So there's a hyperbolic version of Birkhoff's theorem that says whenever you have this SO2-1 symmetry, all the tensor modes are set to zero. So then to get what we want out of the simulation, we do two simulations, one of them where two bubbles collide, one of them where there's no collision at all, and we just take the difference. Okay? So this is our difference in, this is our metric perturbation here, and then we get the trace out, and we get the symmetric trace-free part out.
So you make the difference at fixed proper time, or at fixed?
So it's at fixed proper time. So really what we do is we do this metric reconstruction procedure for both our bubble with no collision and our bubble with a collision. So implicitly, we're picking out the synchronous gauge. So the difference is really a difference of these metrics as a function of tau, the proper time, and position.
Okay, would that guess as a function of field value would be more physical? Because in proper time, in two different space-time happens to each other. So I think that could be the same. So,
well, at the linear level, that's what a synchronous gauge metric perturbation is.
Right. But I guess it's the choice.
Yeah. So it's a gauge choice, but in two dots down, we're going to go to a different gauge. So maybe it would have been appropriate to do something differently, but this is what we did. So we can simply extract these two quantities that we care about. And this is basically a nonlinear generalization of the perturbed Robertson-Walker metric in synchronous gauge. So there's no assumption that these deltas are small. There need not be an assumption that they're small. However, it's a little bit more convenient to extract the co-moving curvature perturbation, which can be performed in regions where these deltas are small by implementing a linear gauge transformation. And here is the linear gauge transformation that is necessary, subject to a few important assumptions. First of all, you need to assume that this symmetric part basically comes from a scalar function, which is a function of only x, so it's linear. So there's some planar symmetry. That's not exact, but it's close enough to work. That's really the main assumption, and also the assumption that the perturbation is small. And here's the answer you get for a particular example. So this is a contour plot of the comoving curvature perturbation in these comoving Cartesian coordinates in an open universe. So if we locate some observer at the origin, maybe here is a cartoon of what his past light cone might look like. And here is R. So you can see that R, first of all, is nearly planar. And look at the scale here. So x of order 1 is the curvature radius in this open universe. So on scales significantly smaller than the curvature radius, this perturbation is nearly planar. And here's the scale. So it does get fairly big over on the right-hand side to about a quarter, but it's remaining fairly less than 1. Okay. If you look at this, this is at a constant time. If you look at this at different times, you'll find that the perturbation does freeze in, as it should. And as I said, the linear approximation does hold in this window. So all those subject to assumption caveats that I said from this picture basically get self-consistently satisfied. We had to assume things were nearly planar. We had to assume that R was less than 1. So that's self-consistent.
You're doing this numerically beforehand, and then you set the conditions, but then once they come inside the horizon, they're still going to be non-linear. How do you know what happens then?
I think if that was the case, it would already be in gross violation of everything that we see. So they can be
non-linear at every time, but they're still linear by the time they come back inside the horizon.
No, so it's more like you make this terrible mess, it's horribly non-linear, and then parts of that terrible mess freeze out to be linear. Parts of that terrible mess are still totally nonlinear. I can tell you what that looks like in synchronous gauge exactly. But if I want to map that onto this quantity R, then that doesn't work. So I made this assumption that it's a linear gauge transformation, and that assumption is wrong in that case. So all I can tell you is that if I keep going in this direction, R keeps increasing. And then maybe it does something that I can't tell you, because I can't calculate that in the linear approximation.
Just that hasn't happened yet. So I mean, maybe observers in the year have to worry about that, but we don't have to worry about that.
Possibly if there's no cosmological constant, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's an empirically good fit. You can fit that rise in R that you'd see along, say, this at the y the x-axis here to a power law. Okay, so here's our empirical fit. There's an amplitude, and then there's a power law of this distance xi minus the distance that the collision happens where it turns on. And this is all a function of delta x, the initial separation between the two colliding bubbles. And then there's some power law kappa. Okay, so here is the position where the collision turns on, and that, of course, increases as the bubbles get farther apart, as it should in this frame. Here's the power law index kappa, which ranges between approximately 3 and 2, and it decreases as the bubbles get farther apart. Here is the amplitude, so that ranges between 0 and 1, and that increases as the bubbles get farther apart. You can think of that as just the center of mass energy is getting bigger, so there's a bigger perturbation. And here's the relative error between what we have for our fit and the actual data. So it's sort of sub-percent level. So it's a pretty good fit. OK, and then what we're interested in, of course, is this signature in the CMB. So we can extract that in the Sachs-Wolfe approximation directly from the comoving curvature perturbation. And more to come later about doing this better. But here's what you get. So you get. You have to stick in the size of the surface of last scattering, because we're projecting our past light cone onto the surface of last scattering. So that's what RLS is. That's just the co-moving size of our past light cone. Here's that amplitude. And then this power law in the difference between the position where we're interested in looking and the position where the collision turns on turns into this cosines. And that is raised to some power, where that power law index ranges between 2 and 3, which is what we saw on the previous slide. OK, so previous work by many people, Clevin et al., Senatore, myself, had always assumed that the power law index in this fitting function was one. Okay, and that at least for this example, is never true. And I think it really will never be true. There really never will be this discontinuous first derivative there. So the rise is a lot more slow than what had been previously assumed. So that's something to take note of. And we'll do a better job once we go beyond Sachs-Wolff and let you know more about that. Some other properties to note. Okay, that's the first one I said. It's never linear in cosine theta. Second of all, it's a hot spot in this model always, and that's because inflation is just the inflaton is advanced by the collision. So inflation always ends early in this region that's affected. That maps to a hot spot. Larger collisions have larger amplitudes for fixed kinematics. That's basically because you're uncovering more of this rise, this power law, so you get a larger observed value for the co-moving curvature perturbation. And in general, at least for this example, if you want to make this consistent with what we see, just grossly consistent, you need to have a very small curvature to beat down the overall amplitude. So for this example that we picked randomly, you need omega k less than about 10 to the minus 7. So curvature would not be observable, ever. Yeah, good. So now we need to build all this into a probabilistic prediction for all of these quantities that we just defined. So I'm out of time. I'll have to go very fast, but I'll just kind of flash the answer maybe in the end. So just briefly, how would one do that? Well, for each point outside of the bubble where another bubble might nucleate and smack into us, you basically have a map onto observables. Maybe it's the observed size of the collision should a bubble nucleate there. Maybe it's the amplitude, et cetera. And since this nucleation process is random and has equal probability per unit time per unit volume, then I can parcel up this outside world and just calculate the differential number of bubbles that come from each of these possible nucleation sites. And that's just related to this probability per unit time, per unit volume, times the four volume. So as I said, there's two intrinsic sources of variability. There's the position of the observer inside the bubble in this frame where the collisions happen at the same time. And then there's how far apart they are in the frame where they happen at the same time. And these two sources of variability map onto the problem I just showed you in the following way. So in the outside, there are these lines basically of constant invariant distance for the two bubbles. So if I fix the kinematics, then as I vary the observer position, I basically move along these lines. And if I do the opposite, I fix the position of the observer and I change the kinematics, I would basically move myself in the outside world along these lines. And so that's my map. My map from these points on the outside to the two sources of variability, kinematics and observer position. Okay, so those two sources of variability basically map onto the observed size and that power law index, which was a function of the invariant distance. And so now we have this number of collisions which came up. And we can recast that into a constant and then a quantity that depends on the exponential of a constant divided by a variable constant beta. So there, maybe now I'm considering an ensemble of inflationary models where I can vary the overall scale. And then there's RLS, which is omega k, in other words, the number of e-folds. So maybe I could consider varying that by varying the size of this inflationary slope. So here are two things that matter for observation. There's the observed number that we predict causally in a causally accessible volume, and then this size of our past light cone on the surface of last scattering. I'm going really fast. These are totally random, arbitrary assumptions of models that I consider in my ensemble, but this is just one choice to test whether or not we can make sense of making such a prediction. And here's the answer. Okay, so this is a set of marginalized probability distributions drawn from this full probability distribution over those four quantities that I just defined. Here is the probability distribution over the observed angular size. And that is more or less as it's always been. It goes roughly like the sine of the angular scale in the sky. So the most probable bubble is one that cuts the sky in half. Here is the probability distribution over the power law index. So that depends on the invariant separation, and it turns out that there's more volume at a certain invariant separation. So that picks out as a preferred value a power law index of about 2.3 or 4. And now the random assumptions. So here is the probability distribution over the number of observable collisions. Subject to two assumptions. First of all, that the overall scale of the potential has no preferred value, so the probability distribution is flat, not in the log of the scale, but in the scale itself. We could change that assumption to flat in the log of the scale. That would change that a lot. And then subject to the assumption that the probability distribution over the number of e-folds of slow roll inflation is a power law. So it goes like the number of e-folds to the minus m, where m is a number in your favorite paper between 2 and 4. Random assumptions, things would change with different assumptions. So given these two assumptions, here's the probability distribution over the number of observed collisions and the probability distribution over RLS. Okay. And you can see this one is peaked around 0, but there's a significant probability in the neighborhood of 0. So this could be bigger than 1 with significant probability. And here, RLS is, again, peaked around 0, but there's significant probability in a perhaps observationally relevant place. And those are, of course, subject to change with different assumptions. But the important part is that if we go back to our question, which is what constitutes a set of predictions and can we make said predictions, the answer is in the affirmative. So I start with some ensemble of models, and I want to get out some prediction for the CMB, for example. And so what I need is to have this expected number of collisions, some observables characterizing each of the individual events, and some probability distribution which tells me how many of each type do I expect to find? So here are those objects. That we get directly. That basically is included in our set of intrinsic variables. So we have variables defining each collision. That's their size, this power law index, which tells me their amplitude and their shape, RLS, which also has something to do with their amplitude. And given these variables, I have a set of probability distributions, okay? So given this information, subject to these perhaps random assumptions and random models that I've picked, it's possible for me to basically construct likelihoods. So I could make fake data with these bubble collisions in them. And that was directly from my set of models, my ensemble of models, okay? So that closes the gap. That's the result. This is a proof of principle. Is it possible to carry through this program and make these predictions? And what's next, of course, is to do phenomenology. So here's this random model or set of models I picked. What happens when I make them more varied? What happens for, say, different single field models, multi-field models, different cosmologies? Of course, we should do a better job of predicting the signature. So we should pull out the TEB, all the correlations, implications for large-scale structure. And then, given these set of predictions, which are on much firmer footing than previous predictions, we'd like to revisit this question of whether or not you can find these things in the CMB. And then the holy grail is to figure out, we're not going to see anything. Nothing has been seen so far. But what does that constraint mean? What properties of the model did we actually constrain? And so probably the most interesting application of this program is going to be to go backwards and say, here's what I see. Here's this chain of reasoning that gives me a prediction. Run it backwards and see what I've constrained. So that is all I had to say. Thanks so much. Yeah?
So I still, I guess, couldn't follow. How many bubbles do you expect to see?
So the the formulas here, here's what it depends on. So it depends on this nucleation rate per unit four volume, sort of normalized to this Hubble scale.
We have that ratio of lambda divided by S to the its initial to the four should be much less than one.
That's right.
Right, because otherwise you cannot use single.
Precisely. Yeah, so there can be a hierarchy of scales between these two guys here.
So when you say
it's
final, where is final?
I mean, F is false.
Oh, sorry.
I is inflation.
Yeah.
Actually, I've got a better picture. Let me go back to the other picture.
False is before and I is... Because in your picture, they look almost the same, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there's this piece which basically depends on this part here, right? The wall region.
Right. But I mean, would that be very big? I somehow have this impression that they should be more or less the same for common loop. At least that's for the thin wall approximation.
This is most probably a horrendously small number. I'm in complete agreement. That's the general expectation.
But somehow then you have something like a few hundred. I don't know whether that's
100. Yeah. So that came again subject to various assumptions. Right. So if I, and really all that depended on was where do I choose my cutoff and how small lambda can get. So if you assume lambda can get as small as e to the minus 10 or something like that, and that rescaling factor can vary by a factor of 100 or something. So that means that the total range can go from e to the minus 10 to e to the minus 1,000 for lambda, roughly. Subject to that assumption, then you have an appreciable enough probability away from zero that you could say that you can make a prediction. But again, these are random assumptions, and that was one particular assumption. You're definitely going to have to do something to compute this small number and this small number. Right, so there's got to be some hierarchy in these two scales. Yeah?
Can you comment on what discussed the large scale structure? If you have all these big bubbles, and you just, let's say, hypothetically measure the density everywhere.
So there's been previous work on that by Tommy Levy. And the upshot was basically that there's some bulk flow associated with the direction on the sky you have this splotch, right? So there were some quantitative predictions, but I think those predictions need to be revisited in light of the fact that we now have a much more accurate prediction. But, I mean, roughly, you have this potential well in some direction that everything is falling into. And so you would have some bulk flow of structure. Now, what magnitude of velocity do you expect? That's quantitatively something I don't know. I'm not sure if it is in this picture. I think the paper you're thinking of is a little bit different. I think there is, like Dick Bond has talked about this at conferences before. I know.
But I'm just thinking that here, I mean, if you have just a ball that cuts across the universe, and
right,
outside you have gradient. I mean, what you're doing here is you're not including perturbations, but the second order, you can imagine, but maybe.
It's limited. Yeah, I mean, so what you might imagine doing is inventing a multi-field model where you've maybe got like a curviton, and the curviton would take different initial values in one part of the universe than another. And in that case, I think you could probably generate some kind of power asymmetry without a huge temperature asymmetry. But in this simplest model, if you went to second order, you'd just find that it was small because you're requiring that the perturbation is small because we don't see some blazing thing on the sky. Thanks.